Well, the story was interrupted by our end of our last session. And Haman has been humiliated by having to honor Mordecai publicly. And his family has seen this as a bad omen for him and have said, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. This is almost like a prophetic word that they gave, perhaps not even knowing they were prophesying, even as Caiaphas prophesied without knowing it, that Jesus must die for the people, according to John chapter 11. So also Haman's family seems to be prophesying. They're seeing that this is not going to go well for Haman, and it certainly is not. At the end of chapter 6, verse 14, it says, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now, Haman hadn't gotten much sleep. He'd spent the evening building a gallows, building a torture stake, really, on which to kill Mordecai. And then in the middle of the night, he'd gone to approach the king to get permission for that. And instead of being able to do that, he was forced to honor Mordecai publicly. That's how he spent his morning. And then apparently around noon, in all likelihood, it came time for this banquet that Esther had invited him to attend, him alone with the king. This was something that when he first heard about it, Haman thought this was a great privilege, a great honor to be alone with the king and the queen, you know, just showing that he held a unique status below the royalty. But this turned out not to be such a great privilege for him, as it turns out. He didn't know that the people that he was trying to destroy, and the man particularly that he was trying to destroy, Mordecai, was related to the queen. And this is going to be revealed to him in this chapter. In chapter 7, so the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Up to half my kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. The reference being sold, no doubt, has to do with the bribe of 10,000 talents of silver. This was the price that had been paid to have them all killed. And so she says, we've been sold to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. Now what she's saying is, this is a danger to my life and my people's lives. If it was only a matter of us going into slavery, I wouldn't disturb you with it, but it's something much more severe than that, where our lives are in danger. Although, if we had been sold away into slavery, the loss to the king would have been hard to compensate. That is, we Jews are actually of great value to the kingdom here. And if you lost us by having us sold away into slavery somewhere, it would have been a great loss to you. But I would have not bothered you with it if that were the only danger. Then King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would dare to presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. As you can imagine, it had not been a good day for him already. And now this was going to ruin his whole day and his whole life. And he was terrified when he realized that he had been exposed. He didn't know until this moment that Esther was related to Mordecai or to the Jews, and that he had even threatened her. He had inadvertently plotted to kill the queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. Now, he apparently needed to think about this. normally, in ordinary circumstances, he probably would have just declared, you know, kill Haman then if he's threatening my queen. But this is a big accusation. This is a big thing. I mean, Haman was the prime minister. To have him executed would be to essentially have to replace him with somebody in a trusted post. This man, after all, had been his trusted minister. And he's going out to, you know, to process this information that his prime minister has plotted to kill his queen. And the king arose and went out to the palace guard, and Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Now, it's hard to picture this, but people didn't sit in chairs in those days. They laid at couches at table at the sides of low tables, and they ate that way. And so Esther was, of course, reclining on a couch, and Haman, apparently, in petitioning her for his life, had, you know, come over to her couch and draped himself over her couch in such a way that it looked somewhat compromising, as the king saw it. And it says, the king said, will he also assault? And the word assault here means sexually molest, sexually assault the queen while I'm in the house. As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face, which means he was condemned to die. The servants came up and put a bag over his head. Haman was very ill-advised to go near the queen. I mean, he probably was going to die anyway, but it really enraged the king because no one's allowed to come near the queen. Only the eunuchs, who were men who were castrated and could not be, you know, a danger to the purity of the harem, were allowed to go near the queens and the concubines of the kings. No ordinary man could do so. In a sense, Haman was somewhat in danger being as near to the queen as he was just at the banquet because, you know, an ordinary man was not allowed to go near the queen, especially a very beautiful queen who might be thought to you know, be somebody who'd be an allurement to another man. Haman made the mistake of apparently even touching her. You would never touch the queen. And although he was, of course, not trying to sexually assault her, it looked enough like that to the king to, you know, have the king make this comment. And of course, when he made the comment, there was no question of what Haman said. It was the servants just came up and covered his head like, okay, I guess this guy's dead, you know. And so Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf. Now, he adds that little thing about Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf. Obviously, the servants were favorable toward Mordecai and not toward Haman. And so he kind of rubs it in. Yeah, he wanted to kill Mordecai. You know, Mordecai is the one who saved your life, who exposed a plot against your life. That gallows is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. And they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. And it seems like that should be the end of the story, but there's still three more chapters of sorts. Chapter 10 is only three verses long, but you'd think the story would end at this point, but there's still some unfinished business, namely that there's still a date set when the Jews are to be annihilated, and that date cannot be altered because that was a law of the Medes and Persians, so that problem has to be resolved yet. However, the story would end happily at this point, and almost like a fairy tale. You know, the bad guy, you know, he things went badly for him, and then the good guys lived happily ever after. And there's a sense in which this part of the story may be seen as a type of Christ, Mordecai being like Christ and Haman being like the devil, and that the devil sought to destroy Christ by hanging him on a cross, and yet it was Satan who was destroyed at the cross. The very instrument that he thought would be the death of Jesus and was the death of Jesus was not the destruction of Jesus, it was the destruction of the devil himself. Through the cross, Jesus triumphed over the principalities and powers, it says in Colossians 2 and verse 15. It also says that through death, Jesus destroyed him that had the power of death, that is the devil. That is, through Jesus being crucified, he destroyed Satan, Hebrews 2:14 says. So the Bible teaches that by Satan's trying to destroy Jesus on the cross, Satan himself became destroyed on the cross, which might be the reason that we find this rather peculiar thing in the Old Testament when the Israelites were bitten by serpents and dying, that God told Moses to make a bronze serpent and hang it on a banner pole. A banner pole was a cross-shaped stick, a stick upright with a crossbeam to hang banners from. And in the Hebrew, it was on a banner pole that this bronze serpent was placed. And we know that Jesus said in John 3:15 that as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. And so the serpent that was lifted up was like an emblem of what happened at the crucifixion of Christ, the Son of Man being lifted up on the cross. Yet a serpent is not a very good emblem of Christ, but of the devil. And it may well be that the reason for the hanging of the serpent, in God's mind, was to depict the fact that through the crucifixion of Christ, through Christ being lifted up, the serpent himself would be destroyed on the cross, through the cross. And so Haman has prepared this gibbet for Mordecai to be destroyed on. Instead, Haman is destroyed on it in a poetic kind of a justice. Now, chapter 8, on that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, that is the estate of Haman, which was very wealthy, as we found earlier in chapter 5, verse 11, Haman was talking about his great riches and the multitude of his children and the ways in which the king had promoted him. Well, all of that estate was now given to Mordecai, was given to Esther. Esther was given the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. So the house of Haman, a great estate, was given to Esther, and she appointed Mordecai over it. The king gave Mordecai his signet ring, which was, of course, the authority to issue laws and documents in the name of the king. The king's signet pressed into a wax seal was that which made something official. And this king had been worn by Haman. And now it's given to Mordecai, so he's made the prime minister in the place of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the provinces, the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come on my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" Then King Ahasuerus said to the queen Esther and to Mordecai, the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree for the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a letter which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written, according to all that Mordecai commanded, to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, which would include Judea, of course, to everyone in his own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. He called in scribes to write in different languages, so Mordecai would dictate this law, and all the scribes would write in the various languages of the people to whom it would go out. This was before the time that the whole empire spoke one language. It was Alexander the Great that conquered this king. And Xerxes lost some serious and important battles to the Greeks because Alexander was expanding at that time his influence. And after this time, Alexander the Great conquered the whole realm. Actually, I shouldn't say Alexander this time. It was actually Alexander's predecessors. The Greeks were expanding. This is not quite in the lifetime of Alexander himself. But the Greek Empire was pressing against the Persian Empire. And Xerxes fought some unsuccessful wars against the Greeks and lost ground. And that gave, eventually, power to Alexander to come and conquer the region. When Alexander did that, he actually imposed the Greek language on the entire empire. No king had done that previously, that is, impose his own language on all of his conquered territories. So that within a generation or so after Alexander, the entire Mediterranean world spoke Greek. But previous to Alexander's time, every place had their own language. So when someone like the Babylonians or the Persians or the Assyrians conquered a region, they had to have persons who spoke the local language to govern that region. And so here also, when laws were sent out to all 127 provinces, they had to be written in the languages of the local people. So they had a lot of scribes would come in. Mordecai would dictate a law, and these scribes would write it down, of course, translate it into the various languages. It says, and he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which was the month of Adar. Now that was the date that was set by Haman by the casting of lots. That day was the day that the Jews would be prepared. I think they were given about 8 months advance notice here, so they could actually fortify themselves. And if I understand correctly, and it's not entirely clear to me, but I think this is what was arranged, that what Haman had arranged was that anybody could rise up and kill Jews on that day. And this was by official decree of the king of Persia so that the Jews would not be able to resist. If the Jews resisted, then all the armies of Persia would, you know, they'd be fighting against the Jews. The Jews would be fighting against a decree of the king. It's more like a death sentence had been pronounced on the Jews. And just as a criminal cannot defend himself against the electric chair, against the police, so the Jews would not be permitted without government reprisals of defending themselves. So that's what changed. They were now given permission to defend themselves. Now, who was it that was supposed to be doing the killing of the Jews? This is not as clear to me as I wish it was, but I think what that money was about was that Haman had offered to pay anybody who kills Jews. And so it would be kind of on a voluntary basis for various people in the Persian Empire to rise up and kill their Jewish neighbors, and they'd be, there was like a price on the Jews' heads. It'd be like they'd get paid for killing Jews. And so every citizen was had the opportunity of being a hitman and to be paid to kill his Jewish neighbors. However, the Jews were now given, and the Jews would not be allowed to resist. But now a decree was made that the Jews could resist. And obviously nobody had to kill Jews. It was a voluntary thing. People who wanted to rise and get paid for killing off the Jews could collect a fee. But now, of course, they're going to be fighting against armed resistance that have permission from the government to resist them. And, of course, they're fighting against the very people who are now ruling the country, Mordecai and Queen Esther, who are Jews. And so it now is not going to be people are not going to be quite so eager to rise up against the Jews, knowing that but some did, and there was fighting. But I think that probably this decree and the fact that Mordecai and Esther were now known to be Jews in high government positions in Persia no doubt changed a lot of people's minds who might otherwise have been willing to get involved in this slaughter. I think a lot of people decided to bow out because of this. We'll find that to be so. Anyway, it says a copy of the document, verse 13, was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Then the couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. Now Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. Now notice the difference between the citizens' reaction to Haman's decree, which was back in chapter 3, when it was announced publicly that all the Jews were to be exterminated on a certain day. The very last line in chapter 3 said, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. It's like the city was not really favorable toward this decree, and they thought it was weird. They were confused. Why are we going to kill these decent Jewish folks? But now that a decree has gone out with equal publicity that the Jews can defend themselves, the city is happy about that. The Shushan rejoiced and was glad. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. That is, they had fear of Mordecai, who is the prime minister and a Jew, the queen Esther, who is a Jew, and the king, who is quite favorable toward the Jews, obviously. If his queen was Jewish and his prime minister was Jewish, and so he was favorable toward the Jews. So if you rise up to kill the Jews, you're obviously taking sides against the king and the queen and the prime minister. Some still did it because it was legal for them to do that. They could make some money at it. But a lot of people decided, I don't know, I don't think so. And some of them even converted to Judaism. It says many of the people of the land became Jews. It reminds me of when Constantine, the emperor of Rome, became a Christian. Many people in Rome became Christians because the emperor is Christian. It's politically safer to be of the same religious convictions as the king. And so although the king here is not said to have converted to Judaism, there was sufficient Jewish authority in the palace that some people thought it would be to their advantage to become Jews also, so they became proselytes, I guess. Chapter 9. Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. So this was the fateful day. Would anyone rise up against the Jews in the present changed circumstances? Well, some did. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in the cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them, because fear of them fell upon all the people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell on them. So all the local officials throughout all the 127 provinces, they helped the Jews. And here's this civil war going on, and the local officials are supporting the Jews because they feared the prime minister, Mordecai. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with them who hated them. And in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Also, it gives the names of the 10 sons of Haman, who are Parshandatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Poratha, Adaliah, Aridatha, Parmishta, Arisai, Eridai, and Vajezatha. These were the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. They killed those sons, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. So the Jews didn't plunder, but they did avenge themselves physically in warfare. On that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done." Then Esther said, "If it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Now that doesn't seem very nice, but in those days, the danger of reprisals from the offspring of political leaders that had been killed was very great. We see it in the stories of the books of Kings and so forth, that whenever a son is left alive of the previous administration or the previous dynasty, there's the danger that he may find supporters and rise up and try to overthrow the existing dynasty. It was just common practice. It was just political practice that you purge the entire family of those who were the previous people in power, so that their offspring don't rise up against you later on. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan, but they did not lay hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives. They had rest from their enemies and killed 75,000 of their enemies, I guess throughout the empire, but they did not lay hand on the plunder. This was the 13th day of the month of Adar. And on the 14th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Now, again, like I said, I'm not entirely clear on how this was carried out, because it's not really, to my mind, made very clear. I may be wrong in saying that it was voluntary of people to rise up. It's possible that Haman had already distributed the money to people who had taken the money in agreement to be hitmen. Basically, these people had said, okay, I'll take the money, I'll kill the Jews in my neighborhood. And if so, those might be the ones who are described as those who hated the Jews. Because it sounds as if the Jews kind of took the initiative in attacking those who hated them and killing them. Although I'm not sure that that's what happened here. The way it's worded, it kind of sounds that way to me. That the Jews knew who they were. They knew who the ones were who were contracted to kill them. And they attacked them and killed them preemptively, perhaps. I'm not really sure how this was carried out. But when it was all over, no one was resisting the Jews in the Persian Empire anymore. And there were more Jews than ever before, because many Persians themselves became Jews. By the way, the fact that Persians could become Jews should be instructive to us that throughout history there have been many people who don't have Jewish blood who become Jews. The Persians had no Jewish blood in them, except the few that may have intermarried with Jews. But by converting to Judaism, they became part of the Jewish community. And, of course, intermarried with the Jews. And how many times this kind of thing has happened throughout history, nobody knows, except that it's happened a great deal. So that there's been a tremendous admixture of Jewish blood with Gentile blood over the years, and it's very difficult to determine whether there's pure Jewish blood anymore in any family, or even what we would consider to be pure Jewish blood. If a person's half Jewish, I mean, they have a Jewish mother and a Gentile father, they're considered Jewish, but they're really only half Jewish. Their daughters are considered Jewish. If they get married to Gentiles, their children will be called Jewish too, but they're only a quarter Jewish by blood. And likewise, the more generations you go down, people will still be called Jewish if they have a Jewish mother, but the Jewish mother might be only one quarter or one-eighth or one-sixteenth Jewish by blood. But there's been a tremendous dilution, according to Scripture and history, of the Jewish race by this kind of thing, people converting to Judaism or marrying Jews. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th day, and on the 15th day of the month they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled town celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day of gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and for sending presents to one another. Now you might say, how could they be so happy about having just had this bloody conflict? But you have to remember that they were for about 10 or 11 months under the shadow of an edict that said they're all going to be exterminated. What could they do? They couldn't go anywhere. The whole empire was, the whole world that was accessible to them was under the Persian rule, and there's nowhere to go. It was just they were counting the days till they and their children and their wives and their families and their parents all could just be wiped out. So this fact that they ended up fighting and killing a lot of people apparently none of the people they killed were innocent. Ugly as that must have been a tremendous relief to the Jews to have lived for many months under the shadow of a death warrant for no reason other than that they were Jewish. They had done no crimes. I mean, try to picture the situation in our own time. If anybody who had been born to Christian parents, even someone who wasn't choosing to be Christian now, but if they'd been born to Christian parents, there was an edict that 12 months from now, everyone has got to go turn themselves in to be, you know, killed because they had Christian parents. I mean, that'd be, what a weird mentality everyone would be living under who had that particular thing hanging over their head. And if that changed, then of course it'd be a great day of celebration. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, as from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. This feast came to be called Purim. It's a two-day feast that the Jews still celebrate, and this book is there to tell us how and why. So the Jews accepted the custom, which they had begun as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them and had cast Pur, that is lots, to consume them and destroy them. Now Purim, the name of the feast, is simply plural for Pur. Lot is Pur, and in a Hebrew language you add im at the end to make it plural, so lots. So Purim means lots, because that day had been selected by casting lots. But when Esther came before the king, and he commanded by letter that this wicked plot be, which Haman had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter, and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants, and all who should join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai, the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdoms of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. And thus we have the foundation of that Jewish feast. Now it's interesting about that Jewish feast that the Jews, of course, celebrate it, but it's not one of the feasts that Moses prescribed. The Feast of Tabernacles and the Feast of Passover and the Feast of Pentecost are all feasts that were ordained by God through God's prophet Moses, the lawgiver. It was a law given by God that they should keep those festivals. Purim, however, was established simply on human authority, that of Mordecai. Now, Mordecai was a Jew, at least, and a pious one. He was a Jewish leader. But it was established on the authority of the king of Persia with his signet ring on the document. It's rather interesting. And the Jews still celebrate that, although it's a holiday that had nothing to do with God's law. In other words, if the Jews did not keep Purim, they would be violating only the Persian king's decree, not God. Likewise, the Jews today celebrate Hanukkah, which celebrates another event much later in history after the Maccabean War, which happened hundreds of years after this. So the Jews have, in addition to the laws that Moses gave and the festivals that he had on their calendar, other festivals by which they commemorate other events. Now, one thing good about having a holiday that's been kept from earliest times without a break is that, in a sense, it confirms the historicity of what they're celebrating, because why else would they be celebrating it? Where did Purim come from? Why would it be called that? What did it mean, if not this? I mean, Purim has been celebrated by the Jews from that time until this. And although there may be things about this story that seem like, how likely is that, you know? How likely is that a Jew would become the queen of Persia, and through her intercession, the Jews be saved from an evil man like Haman? I mean, it sounds like a fairy story, but one of the things that confirms that it's historically true is that the Jews have celebrated this very story from the time that it happened until now. And if the story didn't happen, what would be the occasion for starting the celebration? You know, it's like the continuous practice of the celebration is a historical confirmation of the events that they're celebrating. Same thing with Passover. Same thing with any of these feasts that commemorate some great deliverance, including Hanukkah. Why would these feasts be practiced? Why would these holidays still be observed? And why would they have been observed all the time if the events that they're celebrating had never happened? What then would originate them? Anyway, the last chapter has only three verses. It says, "And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his kindred." It's interesting. It says that the position of Mordecai and all the great authority that was given to him is recorded in the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. Now, the writer of this book lived at a time when those records were apparently available. Perhaps they may be yet found, although not likely, because unless they were copied as assiduously as the Bible was, the documents would be so thoroughly dilapidated by now that, you know, they certainly wouldn't exist anymore. The only way ancient documents like this ever survive is by people having some motivation to copy them and copy them and copy them over hundreds of years, because the copies become old. And this all happened 500 years before Christ or more. And that being so, I mean, even documents that were written at the time of Christ, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, have barely survived and in very poor condition. You know, the reason we have the Bible is because, although it was written back that long ago, there was someone motivated to keep copies reproduced up until more modern times. But what motive would anyone have for recopying the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia through the centuries, especially after Persia fell and was no longer an important empire? Why would the Greeks keep, you know, copying these Chronicles of the Medes and Persians? In other words, these Chronicles are not likely ever to be found. But they certainly existed at one time, and the author knew of them and knew that if people of a slightly later time wished to check out the details of this story, you could find it in the Chronicles of the Medes and the Persians. Now, Mordecai here is made out to be the big hero. It's actually Esther who put her life on the line, although Mordecai was very important in the story too and encouraged her to do it. But this story is a little bit like the story of Joseph, in a way. Both Esther and Joseph were ordinary Jews without any political rank in a foreign country. Joseph in Egypt and Esther in Persia. Both of them, through the providence of God, were raised to positions of very high authority, high influence in the pagan world. And both of them were used by God to save their people. Joseph saved his people from a famine, and Esther from extermination. So there's actually a number of details in the story that some people feel are intended to be seen as similar to that. You know, for example, Mordecai got his name written down, though he wasn't immediately remembered, by exposing a plot by two servants of the king who wanted to kill him. Joseph encountered two servants of King Pharaoh in prison. One of them apparently had made a plot to kill the king, but it was through Joseph's encounter with them that he was later remembered and brought to authority. So in a sense, both Mordecai and Joseph, through contact with a couple of the king's officials, did things that were later remembered and had a lot to do with their elevation to influence. Anyway, one thing I'd like to say about this also before we're done, and we are essentially done, is that in later centuries, some Jewish writer added a prologue and an epilogue to the book of Esther. This prologue and this epilogue are actually attached to the documents now. Many ancient documents of Esther have these on them. They are what we call apocryphal editions. Just like certain whole books are apocryphal books, like the books of Maccabees or Tobit, which the Roman Catholic Bible includes them as scripture, but Protestants don't recognize them as scripture. They're called apocryphal books. So there's portions of Esther that exist in the Roman Catholic Bible that are not included in the Protestant Bible because they're apocryphal. And the reason they're called apocryphal is they weren't written at the same time. They're not originally part of the book. The book was apparently written in the 5th century B.C., but it was probably in the 2nd century B.C. that the apocryphal prologue and epilogue of Esther were written and attached to it so that it's now part of the documents. But it's written by a different hand. And what's interesting about it is it's written in what we'd call apocalyptic style. Now, apocalyptic style is that style that the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel and the book of Zechariah are written in. Apocalyptic style was actually a very popular style of writing among the Jews in the 1st and 2nd centuries B.C. And when the book of Revelation was written in the 1st century A.D., it was following a style that was very common and popular among the Jews called apocalyptic. And the apocalyptic writings usually involved dreams and or visions where there were angels and monsters and beasts and dragons and things like that, which were playing out a drama that had symbolic meaning. Now, there is value in noticing these apocalyptic writings from the time before Christ, because we have a tremendous difficulty in interpreting one of our books of the Bible, the book of Revelation, which is written in that style. And as Westerners, we tend to take writings more or less literally. And so Western Christians have tended to take Revelation relatively, I say relatively, really there's tremendous compromise even in this, but somewhat literally, because we do not recognize the style. But one thing about the apocalyptic, apocryphal additions to Esther that is helpful is that we know what the story really was, but we also have the apocalyptic telling of the story in these apocryphal additions to it. I want to read them to you because the prologue that is attached to Esther by this later hand is written in an apocalyptic style, and it professes to be Mordecai writing it. It's another thing about the apocryphal books. They often claim to be written by somebody who didn't write them. But because the writer attached this as an introduction to the book of Esther, he pretended to be Mordecai. And he said at the beginning that he had a dream. Now, in this prologue, we have him relating the dream that he had. And it sounds like something directly out of the book of Revelation because it's a typical apocalyptic style of dream. But then at the end of the book of Esther, he adds an epilogue at the end, just a paragraph, where he explains the connection of the dream to the story itself. And how this is an advantage to us is that we see exactly how these apocalyptic writers would use imagery to depict ordinary historical events. Let me read this to you. This is how the apocryphal prologue to Esther reads. It's Mordecai giving a dream that he said he had. It's not really Mordecai, it's a later writer claiming to be him. He says, quote, "Behold, noise and confusion, thunders and earthquake, tumult upon the earth," or tumult, "and behold, two great dragons came forward, both ready to fight, And they roared terribly. And at the roaring, every nation prepared for war, to fight against the nation of the righteous. And behold, a day of darkness and gloom, tribulation and distress, affliction and great tumult upon the earth. And the whole righteous nation was troubled. They feared the evils that threatened them, and were ready to perish. Then they cried to God, and from their cry, as though from a tiny spring, there came a great river with abundant water. Light came, and the sun rose, and the lowly were exalted and consumed those held in honor. That's the dream. And that is presented as an introduction to the book of Esther. And at the end, we have this epilogue that the same writer adds. After the story is closed, after chapter 10 of Esther, they add this little bit. He says, I remember the dream that I had concerning these matters, and none of them has failed to be fulfilled. The tiny stream, which became a river, and there was light and the sun and abundant water, the river is Esther, whom the king married and made queen. The two dragons are Haman and myself. The nations are those gathered to destroy the name of the Jews, and my nation, this is Israel, who cried out to God and were saved. Unquote. Now, what's interesting about this is there's an actual story, a historical story with ordinary events in it, but the apocryphal dream is written in an apocalyptic style similar to that of Revelation. There's dragons roaring at each other, and all the nations of the world are mobilized, and there's earthquakes, and there's lightnings, and there's thunders, and there's this little river that becomes a great river, and water. I mean, all those are images you find in the book of Revelation, or for that matter, in all the apocalyptic writings of the Jews. There are many apocalyptic writings of the Jews that should not be regarded as scripture, and they're not. But they all use this kind of imagery. So when you read the book of Revelation, written in the first century AD, you recognize that the Jews and Christians who were acquainted with this apocalyptic literature would have immediately found the book agreeable with the kind of literature they were used to reading. And of course they would not think of it as literal, any more than that, you know, Haman and Mordecai were literally dragons, or Esther was literally a little spring that became a river. And so these additions to the book of Esther actually become instructive for us in just understanding how the Jewish mind used apocalyptic imagery to describe events that we actually know the story behind. And so, you know, that can be helpful to us and warn us to not be overly literal in our approach to other apocalyptic writings, including the book of Revelation. Well, we come to the end of Esther now.